Thank you, Reuben. That was spectacular. The saxophone is now being considered in so many religious communities because of its intimate connection with the human voice. Apparently, this is something that a lot of jazz saxophonists are now getting another venue that they can use to keep themselves employed. So that was great. Oh, right. Yeah, but no. Good morning. I'm Ralph Tiksinski, minister here at Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. We provide a variety of programs, Sunday services, presented either by one of our lay members or members of the community. Today, Warren Hagstrom is going to be presenting on the myth of romantic love yesterday and today. We welcome people of every ethnic background, color, religious background, any age, whatever your sexual orientation, your abilities or inabilities. We especially want to welcome any visitors that may be with us this morning on this cold Sunday morning. Winter is here, and we especially want you to feel free to introduce yourselves, if you choose, later in the service. Now for our opening words, Anne London will lead.
That's great. Welcome, lovers of life. This is William Shakespeare's 18th sonnet. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometime declines, by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that thou owest. Earth shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee.
a caring community, we now take time to briefly share special joys or concerns with our gathered group, or any personal concerns with the congregation.
I recently learned that the Madison Gas and Electric Company is building a new furnace to burn coal, and I'm really horrified. I don't understand how we could let that happen when we've got other ways of going. They make too much profit. I think we should put it back in the company and go forward with new stuff.
Well, I got news this week that my college roommate, Burl Brinkman, died. She was just 67, and she had a father who lived into his 90s and a mother who lived to an old age, and, you know, no one expected, you know, we expected another 25 or 30 years from her. But she was a great world traveler. She'd been in the Peace Corps, and she really never stopped traveling. She traveled to all countries of the world, had just returned from a trip to Mexico with her younger brother. Slept overnight at her own home, and suddenly I think had a heart attack and died immediately. So this is quite a shock to me.
From our community, we've lost George Calden and Pat Cotley recently, and it also feels like a personal loss to me that Molly Ivins died. And so I think it's up to us to carry on all of their work.
I have a couple of things. Dave Zachem called us last night, and he'll be here Monday, I'm staying with us, so for a while. He's got a job in Mogadishu, Somalia, which he's quite happy about. We'll keep tuned. I'm sure you'll learn more. He'll be around for a while here visiting before he goes off to Somalia. The other thing is that I attended our annual wetlands conference sponsored by the Wisconsin Wetlands Association in La Crosse the last few days. And it was a wonderful conference. We had close to 500 people from six states, and the emphasis was on the upper, on the Mississippi River, wetlands, Mississippi River watershed, wetlands. Mississippi River drains about 40% of North America, well, United States, at any rate. And we learned a lot about the connections between Wisconsin. Wisconsin, Minnesota, parts of the watershed, and the Mississippi Delta region. Anyway, it was a great meeting.
Hi, I'm a visitor here today. My name is Sean. I've been here several times before. I just wanted to show you this picture of my dear friend Katie, who passed away 2 weeks ago. 26 years old, she was killed in a car accident, and she leaves behind two little girls and a fiancé. She was to be married in April. So.
Now, it was obviously a sorrow for all of us to lose George Calden, but it was a great joy to have such a wonderful memorial service for him yesterday at First Society, and it was a really, really, really good service. And I have to say, I told a few people, I preferred George's memorial service to my mother's own funeral about a year ago, which was a little bit too morose, and George's was much better.
This morning, I'm going to try to delineate the major elements of what I'll call the myth of romantic love. And then I wanted to discuss some possible functions of the myth. And since I'm quite ignorant of pop culture since the Beatles, I'll be asking you about how the myth survives, if at all, today. We just heard one expression of the myth. You might say that we idealize the beloved. And it's, we'll have another one in song from Paula and Carl. Paula and Carl. There's usually some cognitive distortion in idealizing the beloved. And there's usually a kind of dissonance between making a commitment and having a realistic view of the other. And the dissonance is resolved by this idealization. Is that lovers are somehow irrational. And this is linked with a belief in love at first sight. You fall in love without knowing anything about the beloved. Both themes are expressed in this next song by Rodgers and Hammerstein. Dean and Eileen will present Some Enchanted Evening. reply, fools give you reasons, and that's me. Love at first sight implies irrationality. And poets have long written about the irrationality of lovers. What I'd like to do now is give you a panel of experts. Al and Eileen will read them. The first one is, let me give the source before. Okay. First, what is the first one? Chaucer? No. It's the number
one. What do with the numerical order?
Yeah, numerical order.
Okay.
Number one.
Bobby Burns.
Bobby Burns.
Oh, this is
good. I'm working out.
Oh, my love's like a red, red rose that's newly sprung in June. Oh, my love's like the melody that sweetly played in tune.
And then the second one is from Chaucer.
Love is blind.
Third is from Francis Bacon.
It is impossible to be in love and be wise.
And the fourth is Jessica's statement in The Merchant of Venice by Shakespeare.
But love is blind, and lovers cannot see the petty follies that themselves commit. For if they could, Cupid himself would blush.
The fifth is Christopher Marlowe.
Whoever loved that loved not at first sight.
The sixth is a line from Shakespeare that you'll recognize from As You Like It.
No sooner met, but they looked. No sooner looked, but they loved. No sooner loved, but they sighed. But they asked one another the reason. No sooner knew the reason, but they sought the remedy.
The seventh is from A Midsummer Night's Dream.
The lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact. One sees more devils than vast hell can hold. That is the madman. The lover, all as frantic, sees Helen's beauty in a brow of Egypt. The poet's eye, in a fine frenzy rolling, doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. And as imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown.
And this is the last one, right? Mm-hmm. That's from Shakespeare. I couldn't find the source.
Love is merely a madness, and I tell you, deserves a dark house and a whip as madmen do. And the reason why they are not so punished and cursed is that the lunacy is so ordinary that the whippers are in love, too.
Thank you. That was probably 12th night, wasn't it? Yeah. Okay, where am I? There are some other themes, such as the idea of eternal love, which was sort of nicely expressed by Paula in the song from The Music Man. A summer romance that ends on September 1st might be romantic, but it's not romantic love. Here is another example of love at first sight. Dolita and Carl will present it. From Guys and Dolls. rationality, socially inappropriate love choices can be expected. Often they are tragic, as in Romeo and Juliet. Romeo falls in love before knowing what family Juliet is from, before knowing that she's an enemy. In musical comedies, the tension of the inappropriate loves can generate laughter. So you have this con man, Professor Harold Hill, and Marion the librarian, an unlikely match. Or you have Bat Masterson, proprietor of the longest running crap game in New York City, and the Salvation Army officer, what's her name? Notice, by the way, if you haven't already, that there is nothing exclusively heterosexual about the myth of romantic love. At least a couple of the guys who wrote the lyrics we were hearing this morning were gays themselves. I think you and I, most of us, have swallowed a good deal of the myth of romantic love. It's all around us. But it's easy to think about cool, detached, logical rationality when it comes to mate and partner selection. I knew a woman when I was an undergraduate had a checklist of desired and undesired characteristics of men, and every date she'd have, she'd go through the checklist. And I don't know if she ever got married, but I suppose she did. Today you can find agencies to check up on prospective spouses. I'll leave the ad in the back later on in case some of you are interested in the service. They'll go through various records with their computers and find out if your prospective mate has been in bankruptcy or engaged in domestic violence, things like that. Computerized dating services are another way of using a rational technique to find a desired mate. I don't know enough about them, but I don't. I'm a skeptic. A better way of being rational in love is to hire an agent to on your behalf, a matchmaker. Just as first-class lawyers, when they themselves are partners in a legal case, hire another lawyer, so should someone in courtship. The saying is, a lawyer who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. And you can say the same thing about people in courtship. The problem with matchmakers, they're not found very much nowadays, is that for whom is the matchmaker an agent? In a traditional society where the interests of parents and children mesh quite nicely, partly because the child will occupy the status of the parent later on, matchmakers make sense. And especially when the nuclear family of husband, wife, and children are really embedded in the larger extended family, then it makes sense to have a matchmaker. It doesn't work today. Once a choice has been made, rationality can come back. Anything goes in wooing. I have seriously courted two women who just loved to dance, and as you may have observed, there's a kind of disconnect between my head and my feet, and I feel awkward on the dance floor. I think I'm as good as most men in the congregation here, but I still feel awkward. Anyway, I knew these women loved to dance, and I persuaded both of them that I love to dance too. way back then in Chicago, I went to dancing classes at the YMCA with the sole aim of being able to dance with that one woman. Anyway, I was so cool and rational that I deceived both of these women. And I, too, have been deceived. I know a woman who detests raw oysters, but on an early date with me, she managed to swallow a bunch of raw oysters. So, how can one explain this irrationality of lovers, cognitive distortions involved? It's often desirable for the individuals involved and for society in general that adults make stable commitments. But there are barriers to going from not involved to having a stable commitment. There are enormous costs and risks. The material costs are sort of obvious. The opportunity costs are there too. Once I get committed to one woman, all these other desirable women are sort of off limits to me. And then there's the larger cost of being rejected. So we know about cases from, well, let's see, there's Goethe's young Werther, who ended up committing suicide, and I understand he's sort of, Werther was imitated in real life by all sorts of people in Western Europe, all sorts of men in Western Europe. A.E. Hausmann, the poet, expressed it nicely in the poem, When I Was One in Twenty. When I was one in twenty, I heard a wise man say, give crowns and pounds and guineas, but not your heart away. Give pearls away and rubies, but keep your fancy free. But I was one in twenty, no use to talk to me. When I was one in twenty, I heard him say again, the heart of out of the bosom was never given in vain. 'Tis paid with sighs a plenty and sold for endless rue. And I am 22, and oh, 'tis true, 'tis true. I think this problem of going from one status to another was clearer some half century ago when most people went overnight from their family of orientation, where they're sort of secure and they know what's going on, into a family of procreation when they get married. Anyway, given the risks and the costs involved, how can any rational person engage in the commitment? And the answer is they've swallowed this myth of romantic love. So they expect to be irrational. They expect to find a white knight or a woman with satins and laces who will smell a cologne. We have centuries of culture from Shakespeare to Gershwin to tell us, let's fall in love. Just a historical point, the myth goes back to the Middle Ages, a rather different kind of family system, but where men in the court were sort of expected to be in love somehow with the lady of the court, who they could never marry. So you have this theme of frustration and idealization going way back. But that old medieval theme was sort of picked up and made use of in a rather different family system, our family system. Most of the songs and poetry we've been hearing go back half a century ago. Since then, our family system has changed a great deal. The median age at marriage has increased, so people no longer go from their family of orientation to their family procreation overnight. An increasingly large fraction of the population never marry, or if they do marry, they get divorced and then don't remarry. So today, a majority of adult women live in households without a husband. Most people, by a very large margin, have sex before marriage or without marriage. Sigmund Freud wrote that love, his definition, love is aim-inhibited lust. The lack of inhibitions today would seem to make love less likely. So has the myth of romantic love waned in pop culture? And I don't know, since I stopped listening to pop music after the Beatles. Yeah, but even with the Beatles, there's a song, Do You Believe in a Love at First Sight? They ask. And John Lennon answers, yes, I'm certain that it happens all the time. But he the way he phrases it or sings it, he's decidedly unenthusiastic about love at first sight. So, I'm asking you as experts about pop culture, if romantic love has, the theme of romantic love has waned. Certainly, I don't think it's there in rap music, is it? Not in most rock. Anyway, I'll ask my assistant here to...
Well, this is probably a year ago. I had read in the New York Times magazine about something I didn't really know about that young people were engaging in. It's called, these are friends with benefits. And that is, you have a friend, you're a high school kid, and you want to have sex. So you have a friend who's willing to do that. It doesn't mean that you're in love at all. It's just a friend with that benefit that they're willing to offer. So I guess that's kind of the opposite of romantic love. It's, you know, we've got a sexual appetite, and let's satisfy it in a kind of a safe, but maybe not so safe way, because part of the discussion in that article was about how it was maybe more of benefit to boys than girls.
This is not an answer to your question, but a little comment from a different culture. German, of course, German literature contains some of the most beautiful love poetry, but it's in English, although translated. But I wanted to let you know that even a Marxist like Bert Brecht, whom many of you, if not all, know as one of the great Marxist writers, had a decidedly romantic vein. And in his many, many beautiful love poems, I would like to just recite for you a very brief one. It's not much longer than a haiku. And it is called, I'll say it in German first and then in English. It's called Morgens und Abends zu lesen, to read in the morning and in the evening. And it goes like this. Der, den ich liebe, hat mir gesagt, dass mich braucht. Darum gebe ich auf mich Acht, sehe auf meinen Weg und fürchte von jedem Regentropfen, dass mich erschlagen könnte. Which means, he whom I love has told me that he needs me. Therefore, I take care of myself, watch where I go, and fear of every raindrop that it might slay me. One of my favorites.
This is to put a question mark in a skeptic up there.
We have a dear friend who lost his wife in Whitewater, and before she died, she knew that so there you are.
Another friend, the same thing happened to her.
Also from maybe another culture, I was thinking, I'm a very big TV fan living by myself, and I don't like quiet very much, so. Two things. One in English, and that's, I mean, if you don't believe that the myth of romantic love is alive and well in pop culture today, then I invite you to watch any movie on the Hallmark Channel. And two, I watch Spanish telenovelas every day. And the telenovelas are all about romantic love, because you can absolutely guarantee that the last episode will be at least one wedding, if not a double or triple or quadruple wedding. And all of the bad guys will die or be in jail, and all of the good guys will be married and live happily ever after.
I wanted to ask, Horan, about, you mentioned in medieval times where there was the idea of an unobtainable love, you know, that someone in court would be in love and would write poetry and such to a woman that they couldn't have a relationship with. And I know that in the Romantic period, which I think is where the term comes from, the idea was there was an unattainable yearning for a relationship with God or with spirit. And the idea that perhaps we've confused the two, so that when the unattainable becomes obtainable, that's where the romance goes out of it. I was just wondering if you knew anything about the Romantic period in literature.
I'll defer to you.
It does seem like the computer matching would, that would be more like making a checklist. But, of course, what happens, for instance, in The Music Man, she had this whole thing of what she wanted in a cottage in Iowa, somebody who's honest and learned, and then the person she falls for is this con man who's totally opposite. And, of course, that's the way, in whether it's Humphrey Bogart and Katharine Hepburn, you know at the beginning of the movie or the romantic novel that the people who hate each other are destined to end up together. So maybe that's another myth that opposites attract, and yet it seems to me there was just something that came out that said that as far as social class and income and so on and education level, people were more and more tending to stay in the same level and stratify that way. So that's just another view.
A couple I know very well who would be a generation behind me maritally, but not necessarily age-wise, are very much in love, and they have a very good marriage, but it's a very functional marriage, and they're very busy, as people are today. I mean, frantically, frantically busy. The kids are always going to, from hopping from activity. I should be being ferried from activity to activity, and the parents always have a million things to do, and it's hard to find 5 minutes to talk to any of them. And that seems to be very standard for today. Now, these are parents who were parents late, as we have people here that, of whom that's true. And I think that's not atypical for today. Their love songs are still from the Beatles. They're drawing on an earlier period to have love songs. They don't listen to the kind of stuff that you pray not to be standing or parked next to at a stop light with the windows wide open next door that's making your car go like this. They don't listen to that at all. They listen to some classical music and to the Beatles and to some jazz, all of which come from different generations than today's that's focused on the earphone thing. Thank God for earphones. I'm struck with the fact, though, that although they are very much in love and they really are very supportive of each other and they work like a unit, the amount of time they actually spend together alone is mostly when they're both exhausted and out of it, absolutely out of it, sleeping like the dead. You know, and they you know, bemoan this a little bit, and they think it'll be better when their children are older. But I seem to remember, and I have more experience than I would like to have with being married, I seem to remember that being married often involved not doing anything else and
staying home and closing the door and turning the phone off and concentrating on each other. And I don't see so much of that now. So I don't know. I wonder if anybody else has that. Maybe with married children or younger brothers and sisters.
I think we have time for one or two more comments.
There was a previous prairie member some time ago who found her second partner in the Wall Street Journal.
One of the questions we were asked when we went into Peace Corps was, have you ever spent a lot of time alone with your spouse? And that was very important because you were out in an isolated place. And actually, there was a couple who divorced. They'd been married like 25 years, and he was a long-haul trucker. And they never had spent that much time, and they divorced. They flew home. They told their children that they were divorcing. They came back and went to separate sites and completed their contracts. But
I did, by the way, ask Gary Simmons about this, and he says there's a whole genre of music that I know nothing about, namely country and western, and I... They're all about what?
Vera and I decided that when you first romantically approach each other, you have a picture frame of what you want, and after you've joined a marriage or otherwise, each of you slowly leaks out of that frame. And you have to decide how you will keep the enough of the picture in the frame to last. And so we finally joined Marriage Enrichment to see how well we could work it out. Well, we've lasted for 60 years, but it's been work. And as somebody said, wedding is an event, a marriage is a process.
Should we have the offertory before Rogers and Hart? What's your choice? Okay, what is the offertory?
Once Upon a Dream.
From Disney's Sleeping Beauty, but it's adapted from a theme by Tchaikovsky, so...
this opportunity now to welcome any visitors, especially, or guests, and if you so desire to stand maybe and introduce yourself if you haven't already done so. We have any visitors here that would like to do that? Stand. Okay. Let's then move to any special announcements that we may have other than those that are written in our order of service announcements.
Well, in the announcement it says that Dave Zakim is going to be here. Galen referred to his being at your house now?
No, tomorrow.
Anyway, he is going to present a PowerPoint presentation about a walk around his block in Laos, where he has been for several years. And I've seen the photos on the CD, but you know, he's going to narrate it. And he's also going to bring some a suitcase full of textiles that he can sell. They're from cooperative groups and families that he knows in Laos. I believe he did sell some things some years ago when he was here, and that's backed by popular demand. That's this Wednesday at 7:30 right here after the potluck.
We've been collecting guest to your table donations, and this is the last Sunday I'll be taking them. So if you want to write a check, or if you happen to bring your box in, or if you have it at home and you still want to get it in, please contact me. And also there's a basket outside the door. And thank you for those who have donated already.
The Prairie Service Auction is a little over a month away, so I wanted to remind those of you that bought a service last year or gave a service that it's up to you, not the committee, to make sure that you make good on it. If you don't make good on it, think of it as a generosity to Prairie, but this is your last month or so to get those promises fulfilled and to think about what you'd like to donate this year.
I just want to remind anyone who is interested in our adult education program beginning next Sunday evening, 7 p.m. right here in the meeting room. There's a sign-up sheet that's on a clipboard right outside the door as you come in. And this is a program that would also be helpful for any new members or people who are interested in Unitarian Universalism, because it does act as a kind of an orientation for people who are still in that learning process. Thank you.
We do have time. Let's conclude by all of us singing Falling in Love with Love. That's the musical comedy way of concluding the program.